From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
The opportunity for me to kind of, you know, break into the business. And when I first started covering the Cowboys in 1981, they were in the midst of competing for the Super Bowl. They never got there during the years that I was there, but they were in the championship game 3 years in a row in the early 80s, and I got a, you know, chance to capture that. So all the excitement about the team. But the other thing, too, I worked for the team newspaper, so I kind of had a different view in addition to my cousin playing on the team. It was a real intimate behind-the-scenes view. And so I learned a lot about football and the football business and the Cowboys being, you know, one of the most popular, if not the most popular team even back then in pro sports.
Jared Bell, NFL columnist with USA Today Sports, and a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Selection Committee. Bell has covered the National Football League for more than 3.5 decades. His journey to become a sports reporter began in his hometown of Detroit, Michigan. There, as a teenager, he began hanging out at Olympia Stadium, home of the Detroit Red Wings, working in the locker room. That led to him becoming an equipment manager for the Detroit Junior Wings and eventually an aide in the Detroit Red Wings PR department. That experience opened his eyes to the sporting world and the industry. Over the years, Bell has been a weekly panelist with ESPN's NFL Insiders. Also, he does Around the NFL as part of the pregame radio show for the Baltimore Ravens on WBAL. Bell has worked for the Marin County Independent Journal and the Dallas Cowboys Weekly. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Jared Bell, NFL columnist with USA Today Sports and a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Selection Committee, Part 2, In Black America.
Doug Williams was promoted. He is now the Senior Vice President for Personnel, so he is in charge of the scouts. And so that's effectively the role that the GM would have. But they fell short of naming him the general manager. So Bruce Allen, who is the team president, will still have the final say, but Doug will run the scouting staff. And so there's Doug, there's a, you know, college director of scouting, a pro director of scouting, who work under Doug, and then Doug obviously under Bruce Allen, and Bruce Allen under Dan Snyder. But Doug Williams, who, and I talked to him this week actually in Richmond at their training camp, you know, he's had, you know, a tremendous amount of experience in a lot of different areas. And I think that's going to help him in terms of, I mean, he was a coach at Grambling. Obviously, he was a player and a Super Bowl hero. He's worked in the scouting industry for a number of years. He's worked on a college level, a high school level. He's had a kid play college football. He was a football player. So he brings a lot of different perspectives. And, you know, he actually worked for Bruce Allen in Tampa Bay.
Jared Bell began his sports journalism career with the Dallas Cowboys Weekly, first as a contributing writer, then an assistant editor, and finally editor in 1989. Prior to joining USA Today Sports, Bell worked for the Marin Independent Journal for 3 years, covering the San Francisco 49ers. In 1993, Bell began covering the National Football League for USA Today Sports, first as a beat writer, now as a columnist. For the last 2 years, he has also covered the NBA Finals. As a journalist, he has the opportunity to express his opinion on a wide range of topics facing the National Football League. Bell's interest in sports began when he was a teenager attending Northwestern High School in the Motor City. He would hang out at Olympia Stadium doing odd jobs, which eventually led to a position in the Detroit Red Wings PR department. But it was his late cousin, former 1978 first-round draft choice of the Dallas Cowboys, Larry Bathea, that convinced Bell to attend college to secure his future. On today's program, we conclude our conversation.
But it was an honor. Let me tell you this, John. When they first called me and asked me to be on the Hall of Fame Selection Committee, I was like, yeah, no problem. Who can't do that, right? Of course I can be a Hall of Fame voter, okay? So Bruce Smith checked. Where do I check the box, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Montana, Ronnie Lott, of course, okay? Dan Marino, no problem. But the problem, as I've discovered over the years, comes in the making the decisions on people who, you know, compare you know, very equally, you know, people that are not automatic first ballot Hall of Famers. Okay, so yeah, you got Deion Sanders, that's no problem. But then you get a guy like, say, Tim Brown, who was a receiver who was up for balloted Andre Reed the same way for a number of years. And then you're trying to compare Tim Brown versus, you know, an offensive lineman who like a Will Shields, right? How do you compare Will Shields, a great offensive lineman for the Kansas City Chiefs for many years, but you don't have a lot of stats for an offensive lineman, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you compare him to an Andre Reed or a Tim Brown. Those are where the real difficult decisions come in, and that's so we meet every year, and we'll have our finalists. We do our preliminary ballots by mail, and then we narrow the list down to 15 finalists, and then we have a marathon meeting the day before the Super Bowl. Usually goes about 9 hours or so, and we discuss all of the candidates in detail. People bring their research, they bring their testimonies, you know, from talking to people around the league about some of the finalists and stuff. And we really kind of hash it out. And then we have a couple more votes in the room before we come up with our final class. So we'll chop it down from 15 to 10. Then we'll have another discussion. And then we'll chop it down from 10 to 7. And we'll have another discussion. And so it's a really thorough, hands-on process that is unlike any in sports when it comes to Hall of Fames in terms of, you know, how you – you know, meet down, how do you narrow down the candidates to reach the final class?
No, that's right. Jared, what happened this past offseason with the owners meeting? Any new things coming up for this 2017 season?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. Maybe the biggest thing that is going to change this year has to do with instant replay, and it's all centralized now. So, you know, the technology has gotten to the point where and really the officiating department has evolved to the point where they want to have all those decisions made in New York. And, you know, there's a couple different ways to look at it. Personally, I kind of still like the idea of the referee going under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
He's there on site and making that call. Well, now he can still look at the play and give his input back to Al Riveron, who is now the NFL's new head of officiating. Now,
Isn't he the first Hispanic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, he came off the field, and he's replacing Dean Blandino, who did a pretty good job, especially when it came to communicating the, you know, the voice of the league regarding officiating matters. And Blandino is going to a network television job, which is something that Mike Pereira, who was the officiating director, two stops before Blandino. There was
right.
Carl Johnson in the middle there, but Pereira really did what Blandino did to an even greater degree in terms of really being a good face and voice for officiating, and led to a national network job for him. So now Riveron is like the fourth officiating director in like 10 or 12 years. I want to say 10 or 12 years. So that's a lot of turnover, really,
mm-hmm.
in terms of that top spot. So we will see how Riveron handles it. But I will say this, there's a couple things about Riveron that you like. Number one, he has been the right-hand man to Blandino for a number of years. So it's not like he's walking into a situation that he's not familiar with. He was one of the guys in the room when they would look at the plays from around the league. I got a chance to spend a Sunday at the NFL's officiating nerve center a couple years ago and got to observe how they do that. You know, they're on the, you know, they've got hookups with all the stadiums around the league, and they're watching all the plays and, you know, giving officials input and things of that nature. Well, now they'll make the calls from New York, but Riveron has been there. So I think in terms of transitioning from Blandino to the next guy, I don't think you can have anyone better, you know, positioned than Riveron to do it. And the other thing about Riveron, unlike Blandino, he actually worked on the field. He
okay.
worked as an official on the field for a number of years before he, you know, got an inside job, if you will. So I think that will help him as well. One other thing that we'll find out how Riveron explains some of these things. The NFL has relaxed its celebration rules, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the NFL for the longest has had the reputation of being the no-fun league.
Right? Right.
Well, the NFL has kind of loosened up a little bit, and they're going to allow some semblance of celebrations. There's some things that are still going to be off limits, and this is where Riveron may have to explain some things, because there will still be judgment calls if the officials deem something to be too sexual in nature or too violent in nature. They'll still draw a flag and or a fine during the week. But that's probably the biggest, you know, those are the biggest changes in terms of what's going to happen on the field. Off the field, we had another franchise move. The Chargers are in L.A. now, so you've got two teams in the L.A. market. They joined the Rams there, leave San Diego after 50-something years. And then we had the Las Vegas situation with the Raiders that went through, although they're still going to be in Oakland for a number of years, 3 years, maybe even 4 years, until the stadium gets completed in Las Vegas. But we know the future of the Raiders is in Vegas.
As of this,
and all, everything that comes with that in terms of gambling or not, and
right,
how the NFL you know, monitors that, and what the policies are going to be, that will be interesting to see how the NFL interacts in a Vegas market when you're talking about that market being one built on gambling. And traditionally, the NFL has tried to do anything it could do to distance itself from the gambling industry.
Has the GM position been filled in Washington yet?
Yes and no. Doug Williams was promoted,
okay,
and he is now the senior vice president for personnel. So he is in charge of the scouts. And so that's effectively the role that the GM would have. But they fell short of naming him the general manager. So Bruce Allen, who is the team president, will still have the final say, but Doug will run the scouting staff. And so there's Doug, there's a, you know, college director of scouting, a pro director of scouting, who work under Doug, and then Doug obviously under Bruce Allen, and Bruce Allen under Dan Snyder. But Doug Williams, who, and I talked to him this week actually in Richmond at their training camp, you know, he's had a tremendous amount of experience in a lot of different areas, and I think that's going to help him in terms of, I mean, he was a coach at Grambling, obviously he was a player and a Super Bowl hero. He's worked in the scouting industry for a number of years. He's worked on a college level, high school level. He's had a kid play college football. He was a football player. So he brings a lot of different perspectives. And, you know, he actually worked for Bruce Allen in Tampa Bay on the scouting staff when Bruce was the general manager of the Bucs. And so if there's anybody who knows what Doug Williams can do and his capabilities, and anyone you would think would be inclined to hire him or not, maybe, but in this case he did give him this opportunity, it would be Bruce Allen. So I thought that was something that was really relevant to Doug getting his shot. If he didn't get it from Bruce Allen, I don't know who else would have done it. That's not to diminish Doug's potential in anything, but I mean, he's 60-something years old, and he's kind of, you know, been in the mix for some of these positions for a number of years, and it hasn't happened. But he's been here in Washington for like 4 years, and now he's got the shot. But, you know, the one thing that he told me that sticks in my mind from our conversation the other day, John, was that he said it still comes down to working with people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all about me, one man, one person. You know, I've got to make sure that all of my scouts are invested in this, all the coaches are invested in it. We can hash out things. It's a team decision. But I want to have the environment established where people feel comfortable giving their opinions and their input about certain players, and you know, we hash it out from there. But he doesn't want it to be a situation where people are having these side conversations, or someone has real, you know, serious questions about a prospect and they don't share that with the rest of the group. So he wants to have that good open communication. And I think from everything I heard before they made the move, that was one of the things that really bode well for Doug getting the job in the first place, is that he knows the people in that building from when he was, some who are still there from when he was a player, others in his 4 years back, but he had definitely had a relationship with people throughout the building, and that can do nothing but help him.
No, that's right. How come Colin Kaepernick is still unemployed?
Oh, I think we all know it's because of the situation.
We know Stan would not, you know, standing for the national anthem, but you had other quarterbacks who, with less experience, have found jobs.
Oh yeah, it's the same, and not even less experience, but yeah, without as much success. So it is really a shame. It's a black mark, no pun intended, on the NFL for Colin Kaepernick to still be unemployed. And now, John, here's the thing, because we saw a situation just in watching the Jaguars over the weekend and how inept their offense is with Blake Bortles, the quarterback they invested in. And then you go beyond Blake Bortles and you get to Chris Henke, to Chad Henne, the backup quarterback, and he is bad or worse. And so the fact that, Kaepernick can't get a job and you've got teams that, you know, have serious needs is just baffling. But we know that this is something that is born from the situation that happened last year. I mean, there have been teams that needed him. And, you know, Baltimore Ravens being another one. The reports came out that Ozzie Newsome, the general manager, and John Harbaugh, the head coach, and the brother of Jim Harbaugh, who coached Kaepernick in San Francisco, the reports came out that they really wanted Kaepernick. With Joe Flacco out for this summer with a back injury, Ryan Mallett, the backup, the quarterback, he's not very good there in Baltimore. Why not bring a Kaepernick? Well, Steve Bisciotti, the Ravens owner, actually came out and echoed what John Mara said in New York, that he was looking at the fan feedback as being a factor. So this has now gone from the protest to people making judgments about whether or not they accept Colin Kaepernick because of the protest, which I just think is appalling. And now, if Kaepernick were to join a team, if the Jaguars all of a sudden tomorrow decided, hey, we want to bring him in because our quarterback is so bad, which they should have done months ago, how successful can Colin Kaepernick be joining a team in midstream in the middle of August? Now, if I'm Kaepernick, I still take the opportunity, but it's almost like you're being set up for failure because you didn't get a chance to work in the offseason and develop familiarity with the playbook, rhythm and timing with the receivers, and not to mention, you know, sharpening your own skills and mechanics. So he may have been working out, and from what we understand, he has been working out, trying to be ready for the opportunity. But at this point, it's almost like you're setting him up for failure. But again, I still think someone needs to bring him in, and hopefully it will happen. But I just don't know if it's going to happen now that we've seen it get to this point. But, you know, your point is dead on. There are so many players, other quarterbacks around the league that don't measure up to Kaepernick's potential. So it's a shame. But shame on you, NFL.
Is there any solidarity with Kaepernick with players that are currently in the league?
I'm hearing that when I talk to some players. And, you know, that's a tricky thing, John, when you talk about solidarity and you're talking 2,000 players. Now, think about it. I mean, you don't have solidarity on a lot of issues, even when they get into the, you know, the nitty-gritty of their labor situation. I mean, that's always a tough sell because guys are, you know, individuals in addition to being part of a collective group. And some guys just like some guys are more willing to speak out, for example, about things that they perceive to be an injustice, whereas other guys may be just trying to hang on to their job and they won't ruffle any feathers. So you've got that dynamic. The other dynamic is the racial dynamic. You don't have a lot of white players coming out speaking on this subject, although you've got one in Philadelphia and Chris Long, who has been, you know, very vocal, not only this year, but even last year when he was with the New England Patriots. So you have a smattering of players around the league that will speak out on it, but they only have so much power. They can talk about it and criticize, but ultimately, the power to make a difference, you know, rests with the teams in terms of the and even, you know, you would think it would be coaches and general managers. But this one has gotten to the point where, you know, it's an ownership thing, too.
In your opinion, why was a Damian Thompson Hall of Fame speech struck such a chord?
Well, I think it was passionate. It was emotional. It was spirited. And it's really kind of something that spoke to a lot of people in terms of, you know, hoping for unity. I wrote about it and I said it was Obama-esque in its spirit. And boy, I got a few comments from I get a lot of hate mail. Whenever I write about racial issues, the hate mail just comes, the emails, they come. And I had a number of people say, well, you really had us with that column until you mentioned Obama. It's like, well, you know, the point being that, you know, President Obama, the first African-American president in our history, definitely represented the sense that we could be united on some levels. And mm-hmm. we know that there's a lot of polarization there, because it's just like there are a lot of people that supported Obama. There are a lot of people who are against Obama just because he was a black man. So there's still that. But at least Obama won the election twice, which showed that it is possible. And so the message of unity that LaDainian Tomlinson expressed, I thought was good. Now, to some degree, it kind of gave me pause when I thought about it on another level. And I said, you know, it's not like we as African Americans should really have to beg people to respect us. I mean, and to accept us and to realize we're different. I mean, I think that's kind of inherent in you know, in just the world in general. We know that there are people that mm-hmm. are different. And so the appeal of that speech to say, okay, really, you know, we've been oppressed, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, we've had our struggles and so on and so forth. Please accept us. And he didn't say that in those terms, but
right.
there was that tone was, you know, was maybe a part of the speech. And there's a part of me that says, you know, really the message should be to the people who are lacking tolerance to check themselves. I think that is the message that needs to be said too. But he said it in a nice way that really kind of inspired people to at least be open to the idea and to, you know, express the need for unity. And I don't think you can ever get enough of that. So maybe someone else comes with a little more fire and brimstone. Someone else comes with a more conciliatory tone. I mean, it's all positive. It's all in the right spirit when you break it all down, especially when you look at some of the situations in this country and, you know, the divisions that are there. So it was good being on that stage, because so often you get to the Hall of Fame and you get to, you know, situations, interviews, other speeches and opportunities that athletes will have to speak on matters. And they all should not be compelled to speak if they really don't want to, but you would think that many should, just because they are people too. But again, to be on that stage, that platform, the Hall of Fame, I thought it was a tremendous gesture by LaDainian Tomlinson to do his part, or to feel like he wanted to contribute that message.
Final question, Jared. Since we're based here in Texas, I went back and looked over some of your articles, and you had a poignant point about Drew Pearson, the original number 88. He's passed the 20-year eligibility to be on the primary ballot. Do you see him getting in the Hall of Fame anytime soon?
I hope so. It's hard for me to predict, and I'm a member of the committee. he would have to be the seniors nominee,
right,
or one of the seniors nominees.
Exactly.
And I think it's possible. It's just so hard, just so, so difficult to project it, because there are a lot of players. But I think Drew has a shot because he was an all-decade player mm-hmm. in the 1970s. Now, if you look at the statistics, there's nothing about Drew Pearson's career stats, like 489 catches or something like that.
Right.
And you compare that to a Terrell Owens or someone who went in recently, Marvin Harrison. I mean, the statistics don't even compare.
But the rules were somewhat relaxed when those wide receivers.
A lot different. You know, the receivers when Drew played, especially when he first broke in, I mean, it was a situation where people could just clobber them up and down the field.
Speaking of Mike Hands.
So, yeah. So it was a different game back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's the thing that we as voters totally understand when we try to compare one guy from one era to the next. And it was
right.
just like when I was telling you earlier that, you know, some of the difficulty in determining Hall of Famers could be, you know, one position versus another position. Well, it's also one era versus another era. But I think
right.
Drew has a shot. He's all decade. And if you go back for like a 60-year period and you talk about all decade players in the Hall of Fame, you've only got like, you know, one receiver, maybe two, and Drew would be one,
mm-hmm.
Who did not make it to the Hall of Fame. So I think there is some sentiment with our senior subcommittee to bring him to the overall committee. And I think if he gets to be the senior committee candidate, his chances will be good. But there's a quagmire of players you know, right. in that category. Another one from Texas I'll tell you to keep an eye on is Robert Brazil. He used to play for the Houston Oilers.
Houston Oilers, right.
And, yeah, he's another one that you look at and say, okay, you know, which guys got overlooked? And he may have been, you know, see, the Oilers were in that same division with the Steelers. The Steelers won all of those Super Bowls, so it's easy to be overshadowed. But, you know, Robert Brazil is another one that I look at and say, okay, that's a guy. Jerry Kramer, we've heard his name mentioned. He was an offensive lineman, a guard for the Green Bay Packers. He's not in the Hall of Fame on those great Vince Lombardi teams. That's another guy like that. But, you know, you asked about Drew Pearson, though. You didn't ask about Jerry Kramer. So I'm going to say Drew Pearson does still have a shot because he made so many clutch catches for the Cowboys, and the Cowboys were so successful back then.
Any final comments, JB?
Just getting ready for the season. I think the one thing that we will see kind of happen, and we've seen so far in the preseason, is that even without Colin Kaepernick being in the league, there are many players around the league who are still willing to protest, to speak about the issues, to, you know, express themselves with various gestures. Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett for sure, Marshawn Lynch, Malcolm Jenkins with the Eagles. And so Kaepernick may not be in the league, but the spirit of Kaepernick is still prevalent. And I think the events that, you know, have happened here recently has kind of underscored the reason and actually kind of given more understanding to why Kaepernick was so adamant about protesting in the first place, and, you know, really kind of raising awareness that, hey, there are some things in this society that still exist that are just, you know, so wrong that we need to address them. And so Kaepernick may have sacrificed his career for this, and at this point it does look like that, but I think history will look favorably on him for being someone who was willing to take a stand when, John, you know, we're not in the 1960s and the early 70s when
right.
it was routine for athletes to take a stand. We've gone many years without many athletes. There have been some here and there, but very few and far between in terms of guys being willing to put their careers, their marketability, their endorsements on the line. And Kaepernick has made that fashionable again.
Jared Bell, NFL columnist with USA Today Sports, and a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Selection Committee. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.